Hello, listeners. Welcome back to a very special second part of an Uncanny Treks episode. We are finishing up our coverage of Al Ewing's first Mighty Avengers series. That's 2013's Mighty Avengers. A lot of the art is by Greg Land. Specifically, Land did the art on 11 and 12. I am Bob in Cascadia. That is Matt in the Southland. We're talking Mighty Avengers Volume 3, Not Your Father's Avengers, issues number 11 through 14. Matt, what goes down in that third and final trade of the first Al Ewing Mighty Avengers series?
Well, the original Sin crossover continues as Luke Cage learns that his father used to be John Shaft and was a part of a 1972 Mighty Avengers team with Blue Marvel, Blade, the Bear, Kalu, and gun-toting reporter Constance Molina that fought the four Deathwalkers who have returned in the present.
So, Matt, what did you think of the reveal that Luke Cage's dad was basically John Shaft?
Luke Cage is pretty cool. He's got to have a pretty cool dad.
I'd forgotten this. I had read these comics a while ago, but there is a whole history of Cage's dad being a former cop and showing up in the 90s Luke Cage series, which is just called Cage. They do a whole thing where he blames Luke for the death of his first wife and the other son. And so this estranges them. And we see this more in the 11th issue, but he lives in Atlanta and he's listening to Bill O'Reilly, and Bill O'Reilly is calling Luke Cage Chairman Luke.
It's awesome. This whole shift to the 70s thing, I thought it was going to be stupid, but it is cool.
Listeners, in general, I hate prequels, but I love the 70s so much. I love blaxploitation films. I love kung fu films. I love 70s comics like Tomb of Dracula and Luke Cage, Hero for Hire, and Iron Fist. I love it so much that I'm willing to overlook my principles about hating prequels and just being, you know, the 1972 Mighty Avengers are the best.
Pushing the name Mighty Avengers is kind of lame, but at the same time, it's okay. I get what you're going for.
This turns out to be wrong because there are a couple of versions of 1950s Avengers. So that predated when this comic came out in like 2014. But I was thinking while reading this that if you go with this, the 1972 Mighty Avengers, that means there were no white people in the Avengers in the 70s. And thus there are no white people in the Avengers until Thor, Iron Man, Hulk, Ant-Man and Wasp joined together. On the Marvel sliding timescale, that's at most 15 years ago. And so it's funny that no white Avengers until 2010 or until 15 years before the present. That's awesome. Even though the 1950s Avengers series that Howard Chaykin did is pretty good, it almost makes me wish they didn't do that. So you could say that this crew is the first Avengers.
Bob, I want to go back just for a moment. I said something in part one that I regret at this point because I forgot about this particular panel. I said that I wanted to read Original Sin. I think they're actually making fun of Original Sin on the first page with whatever this eyeball guy is.
Oh, Orb.
Orb, and it says earlier, it's a bomb full of secrets. And what do bombs do? It's an eyeball holding an eyeball. Apparently that was what was going on in Original Sin. Look
at it. I'm going to defend this a little bit. Jason Aaron wrote Original Sin, and by all accounts, Original Sin is not good, but I do really like Jason Aaron's stuff. And he got his start at Marvel writing Ghost Rider, which I do think his run on Ghost Rider and Matt Fraction's run on Immortal Iron Fist were big influences on this. And in his run on Ghost Rider, which we should do sometime, it's really fun. It's pretty short, too. I think it's only four trades. In his run on Ghost Rider, he resurrects this great old, I think 80s, maybe 70s, probably 80s ghost villain, Orb, whose head is just a giant eyeball. Orb is awesome. Jason Aaron writes him awesomely. Then in Original Sin, Orb somehow gets cosmic powers, which maybe you shouldn't give Orb cosmic powers. I want to defend the Orb as a villain, though.
In this particular panel, it's rather awkward and does not make me want to read Original Sin.
Don't think you would enjoy. But from everything I've heard. But speaking of Jason Aaron and speaking of the prehistoric Avengers, I did want to point out, besides our 1972 Avengers and besides Howard Chaykin's 1959 Avengers and besides the Agents of Atlas, who are sometimes portrayed as 1950s Avengers, other prehistoric Avengers are not. Well, one of them is prehistoric and one of them is historic. You've got, in Jason Aaron's Thor run, he introduces an Avengers of 1000 CE or 1000 AD. Then in Jason Aaron's Avengers runs, he introduces the Avengers of 1 million BCE. Have you seen the Stone Age Avengers that Jason Aaron did a few years ago?
I've never heard of this stuff.
Do you want to read down the roster for Jason Aaron's
this is fascinating.
Avengers of 1 million BCE. Yeah.
So you have Odin. You've got the First Phoenix.
Iron Fist. Odin and the First Phoenix are lovers, and you find out that Thor is the child of Odin and the First Phoenix.
Oh, wow. Spoilers. Okay. Iron Fist, Ghost Rider, the first Ghost Rider, Black Panther.
The first Black Panther.
And then Sorcerer Supreme.
The first Sorcerer Supreme.
Wow.
Remember Starbrand from John Hickman's Avengers?
Oh, of course.
You basically have an early Starbrand on the team as a proto-Hulk.
Okay, so Starbrand does fit in there somehow, because that's a Hickman-created character, right?
No, Starbrand's a new universe character from the 80s. That was Marvel's attempt to do a new universe of characters. But then Hickman somewhat reimagines the Starbrand and reimagines, I can never remember, was it Nightmask or Nightmark?
Nightmask. Okay, yeah. He was able to breathe new life into these characters who were obscure.
And in the sense he is a Hickman creation in that it's not the same version of Starbrand and Nightmask.
Yeah, we had the same discussion during our Hickman coverage.
In the distant future, I wouldn't mind covering the Jason Aaron Avengers run with you on an accelerated timescale. Because there's too much of it.
Yeah.
It's good and it's fun, but I don't think it would pay off the slow attention that the Hickman Avengers pays off, if that makes sense.
Looking at issue number 11.
Our first issue for this trade, Matt, is issue number 11. I already talked about the trivia about Luke Cage's ex-cop dad, so this is not a new character. Seeing him presented visually as John Shaft in the early 70s is new, but in general, it's not his first appearance. And then the other bit of trivia from issue number 11 was back in the 70s, we see a headline that did you catch this, that it says the Submariner spotted in soup kitchen, ?
Well, yeah, Bob, because remember he was living up in that soup kitchen as a derelict or something.
Which is, we covered that, and listeners, if you want to go back and listen to our first episode on the first Fantastic Four epic, we cover around the first 20 issues of the Kirby Lee Fantastic Four. Obviously, we see the Submariner has been living as an amnesiac homeless guy ever since the end of World War II. But it's funny because in that comic, it means he's been an amnesiac homeless guy for 15 years. But on the sliding timescale, it means he's been an amnesiac homeless guy for 60 years. Do you want to read through my guesses at your favorite panel, Matt?
Bob, you believe that on page 12, Blade's first thought upon seeing Kalu is to stake him. Well, duh. What else would Blade do?
Kalu is not a vampire. He's just a sorcerer. But when you're a vampire hunter, every problem looks like it needs a stake. As far as I can tell, this is the first time we've ever seen Blade being shown active as a vampire hunter before Fantastic Four number one on the sliding Marvel timeline. So that's interesting. Given that he's like half vampire, he's immortal probably. So it makes sense that you could have him originate in the 70s or even earlier. And it's cool storytelling. But as far as I can tell, this is an innovation from Ewing.
I really love Blade's costume here. This yellow trench coat thing he's got going on is cool.
His original costume from the 70s.
Yeah, I need to bring this into the MCU.
I don't think they're going to.
I think they could with the Fantastic Four, Bob. Come on. They had that looking dated, and you know, they had the...
If they ever do a Blade movie, Matt, I don't think they're going to visually have a Blade movie. As much as I might like them to, I don't think they're going to make it visually similar to
them. I mean, can you imagine a movie set in the 70s with Blade? I'd watch that. I think that'd be awesome. It would also make it distinct from the other films.
Matt, my other guess for your favorite panel was we have Blade calling Kalu Glamrock Dracula and Kalu responding by calling Blade Spork. I thought you might find that very funny.
Yeah, the Spork comment was pretty hilarious. Definitely my favorite.
All right.
Dropping the Spork.
What was the cliffhanger for issue number 11?
Constance Molina and Kalu calling the Mighty Avengers hotline.
Of the six 1972 Mighty Avengers, Matt, Constance is the only one who's a new character created for this series. All right. So in issue number 12, you want to run down my guesses at your favorite panel?
So, Bob, you think that 1972 Blade, the Deathwalkers are elemental super vamps. Got it. And then Bear says, not everything has to be a vampire. True. Most things to Blade are vampires, though, I think.
Yeah. Or super vampires.
You've got Kalu unveiling his black magic form, which was pretty cool. I have to admit that. That was neat. It turns out that Bear is a bear.
I think that's a reveal. I don't think we knew that. She appeared in the Karen Gillan Iron Man run. Uh-huh. She does a heist with Tony Stark's dad, but I don't think we knew that the bear was a bear. But maybe I'm wrong.
I don't think we did either, because looking at this, it was a big deal for this person to turn into a bear. They made it clear by showing it over several panels, which that's probably my favorite panel, is actually the transformation piece here. It goes from a white woman to a very scary bear.
Some say bear, some say Karen.
Then you've got Blue Marvel being sore at the Deathwalkers for making him blow up his classic modern architecture subway station underneath New York City Hall. He did let it fall on top of him and dug himself out, which he could have just left and then destroyed it. I don't know why he felt the urge to.
Yeah. What's the cliffhanger for each involvement?
Well, Bobby, Clue is bitter at Black Bolt, and he and Constance Molina finish their exposition to the present Mighty Avengers.
They're explaining to the present Mighty Avengers that there was a 72 Mighty Avengers. Matt, for the last two issues, we have Sal LaRocca do the art. And you know LaRocca from Matt Fraction's Invincible Iron Man. And do you remember the Age of Apocalypse book, Gambit and the Externals?
I know of it. I never read it.
I thought we had one issue of it. It was Gambit basically leading the Starjammers.
No, I didn't read that.
It was cool. Okay. But LaRocca did the art for that, too.
Yeah, I did appreciate Invincible Iron Man. I don't think you liked it. Did you like it as much as I did?
I did not like it nearly as much.
Okay. And
part of it is I think Iron Man books get dated very easily, more so than any other superhero. I will admit, I like LaRocca's art in other contexts, but I did not like it very much on the Fraction run.
Okay.
That LaRocca's art was part of why I didn't like that run. But I like the LaRocca art well enough in 13 and 14. So a couple bits of trivia for issue number 13, Matt. We find out, or maybe we probably already knew this from another book, but Blade is dating Spitfire, who's a British heroine who's, I think, somehow related to patriotic World War II hero. I know there's like a whole history of British patriotic heroes and World War II and vampires that come up in Captain America, and I've never read that stuff, so I'm just not familiar.
Yeah.
And one of the reasons I like Sal LaRocca's art in this issue is especially in this Blade and Spitfire scene. It really reminds me of Eduardo Risso's art, the guy who does 100 Bullets and Broken City and works with Brian Azzarello constantly, and I love Risso's art, so anytime I'm reminded of Risso, that's a good thing to me.
It does have a similar vibe to it.
I have a guess at your favorite panel.
Well, Bob, you said that my favorite panel was Young Power Man using the chi of New York City to watch Chain Blade fight Were Scorpions on psychedelic pay-per-view. That's pretty cool, Bob, especially when Blade rips that scorpion's tail off.
That was great. I just thought you would really like the phrase psychedelic papers. I thought that would speak to you as a wrestling fan.
Speaking of dated terms.
Hey, man, I'm about to pay $50 to watch a pay-per-view today.
It's PLE, isn't it?
PLE? What does that stand for?
Paid live event. No, what is it? PLE. That's what WWE changed it to.
You may not know this, Matt, but AEW is retro.
We got pay-per-views. Excuse me. Premium live event. That's what it stands for.
Calling it a PLE seems a little bit insisting on referring to the wrestlers, not as wrestlers or athletes, but as superstars. It just seems to me a little bit of WWE Orwellian double thing.
You mean sports entertainers?
Exactly.
I think pay-per-view went out the way because it's not technically the way pay-per-view was a legit copyright thing, wasn't it?
Man, I am sending $50 to a streamer to watch something. That's not a pay-per-view. What is that?
It's not official pay-per-view.
If they were, dog, do you want to send me $50 to watch a premium live event? I would say go to hell. Also, wow. If you're paying to see a premium live event, that sounds like you're buying a ticket to see a show.
It does, doesn't it? Maybe it makes it feel more special for the WWE fans when they think that they're getting more than what they're
the least special people on earth do need to be made some special.
Well, the difference though too, Bob, is PLEs usually are just on streaming services, so you don't actually have to pay for them. That may be why they've switched it up, because you're paying for the streaming service on like for WWE.
But you're paying for a special different streaming service, right?
But technically you have to have ESPN Plus or something right now, but if you have ESPN Plus, you get it regardless.
The selling point for getting the ESPN thing, if you say you don't like sports and you just like wrestling, you're getting the ESPN service to watch the PLEs and to watch the catalog. Is that the selling point?
I think so, yes. That is what they're doing.
Where do you watch SmackDown?
SmackDown's on regular USA.
So you have to have regular cable to watch SmackDown, and you have to have Netflix to watch
Raw.
Raw, but Netflix doesn't have much of a back catalog?
No. And Netflix is also dropping special programming.
Saturday Night Main Event?
No, that's NBC. That's on regular cable.
God.
Yeah, it's crazy. I'm telling you, Bob.
What special events that Netflix is doing?
Oh, but not special events. WWE Untold and backstage stuff.
Oh,
like documentary
stuff.
Type stuff. But those same documentaries are also sometimes on Peacock.
I think their time on Peacock is winding.
It is. WWE was basically a streaming whore.
Oh. All right, Matt, what's the cliffhanger from issue 13 into issue 14?
So, Bob, the four Deathwalkers, they merge into a dinosaur-looking Deathwalker Prime.
All right. Do you want to run down my guesses at your favorite page for number 14, Matt?
Sure, Bob. So you got Luke Cage calling Deathwalker Prime Monster Island and punching him. That was pretty funny.
Like the Monster Island, right? Yeah. Walt Simonson Fantastic Four.
We love some Monster Island, Bob. Monster Island's a fun place to hang out with the Mole Man. You've got Luke Cage looking at all the other Avengers having become Avengers Prime to fight Deathwalker Prime and hoping this isn't some Dark Phoenix shit. That was my favorite part.
Always nice when Luke Cage can do the meta voice of having read comics to the reach.
Because it was really, really weird, Bob. That it got so strange when they all formed into the Avenger Prime.
Arguably, you could say Deathwalker Prime and Avengers Prime, maybe a weak way to end out this series, but I don't know. You got to do something.
It was literally Power Rangers.
It was very Power Rangers. Or was it more Transformers?
I'd say Power Rangers because they all had to come together to form Avengers Prime, and then the Deathwalker just got bigger.
I guess I'm just thinking Optimus Prime, Avengers. That's a pretty superficial similarity. You're right. So, Matt, what's the cliffhanger for the end of issue 14 and the end of the Mighty Avengers Volume 3, Not Your Father's Avengers?
Well, Bob, White Tiger and Young Power Man are going on a date, and the Mighty Avengers hotline will continue in Captain America and the Mighty Avengers number 1.
All right, listeners. So that's, I believe, a 9-issue series. We are going to cover that next. Then we will rank Mighty Avengers and Captain America and the Mighty Avengers as one entry on our list of things we've covered. From there, we've got, I think, 4 other Al Ewing Avengers series to cover. We're going to cover his spinoff of the Hickman into New Avengers AIM. We're going to cover his version of the Ultimates, which will continue the stories of Blue Marvel and Spectrum. Good times. All right, listeners, join us next week as we take up Captain America and the Mighty Avengers. We could probably fit 9 issues into one episode. Surely we can. All right. Well, this has been Uncanny Treks. I'm Bob in Cascadia. That's Matt in the Southland. Have a good night, everyone.
Thanks for listening.